Welcome to BrainBeat, the podcast that explores the fascinating world of brain health and function. I'm Dr. Heidi Rossetti, a clinical neuropsychologist and your host. BrainBeat is brought to you by BrainWise, a free digital magazine committed to making brain science understandable and approachable for everyone. BrainWise is a collaboration between the National Academy of Neuropsychology, NAN, and the NAN Foundation. Join us as we explore the latest discoveries in neuropsychology, brain science, and brain and cognitive health. Today's guest is Dr. Pauline Mackey, professor of psychiatry, psychology, and obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Illinois and a leading researcher at the forefront of women's brain health. She's internationally recognized for her work on how menopause and hormones influence memory, mood, sleep, and cognitive aging. All right, Dr. Mackey, you have spent much of your life studying this topic, but for those who are unfamiliar, in a nutshell, what happens in the brain during the menopausal transition?
So, Dr. Rossetti, thank you for having me. I would like to share with you the perspective that we know quite a bit. We have reliable, reproducible information about what happens to us cognitively as we transition through the menopause. We do not have that high quality data on what happens in the brain that explains what's happening to us cognitively. That research is underway. There are some hypotheses, but we don't have the definitive answer. And maybe we can have a conversation about that.
Absolutely. That is such an important distinction. So much more to be learned, obviously, about brain function. In a nutshell, is there sort of a take-home theme or commonly accepted understanding of what happens cognitively during the menopausal transition?
Yes, here we have really strong data. So what do we mean by strong data? We mean that there are six large, well-conducted research studies that all give us the same answer. So that's what we want in science. We want a very strong, reliable, reproducible finding. So how do we know? Well, researchers follow large groups of women as they transition from being premenopausal to being perimenopausal to being postmenopausal in some cases. So maybe we should define those stages. Premenopause is when we're fertile. For many of us, some of us, it's not the case, but it's when our menstrual cycles are pretty reliable. They usually come once every 28 days or so. We begin to enter the perimenopause when our menstrual cycles switch from coming once every, say, 28 days to being 7 days later or earlier, and that happening reliably. So let's say you usually get your cycle once every 28 days, and then suddenly it's 36 days later, or it's 41 days later, or even 17 days later. That's when our ovaries are shutting down. That's when the menopause is beginning to happen. And then when we start skipping periods, so we go a whole month without our cycle, that's when we're entering the late perimenopause. And the reason that I think it's important for women to understand how they can determine where they are in the transition is because it is in that perimenopause period that cognitive changes occur. They don't occur after the final menstrual period, which is the beginning of the postmenopause. The cognitive changes precede that final menstrual period. That tells us that when we are experiencing changes in the regularity of our menstrual cycles, and when we're skipping our cycles, and when we're having cognitive issues, that makes a lot of sense. That tells us that these are menopause-related cognitive issues. So then the question is, what are those cognitive issues, right? So here's where we have large numbers of women followed from the time they're premenopause to perimenopause. And we have six studies following large groups of women where they measured menopause stage correctly, and they gave really high quality standardized cognitive tests. So they tested memory, they tested attention, they tested executive function, our ability to plan, to be mentally flexible, in other cognitive abilities. And there's really one domain of cognitive abilities that changes longitudinally as we as women transition from being premenopausal to perimenopausal. And that's our ability to do what we're doing right now. That's our ability to listen to verbal material, to encode it. And then maybe when you're talking to your friends or your family or your loved ones, recall what you learned verbally. So verbal material is information that we hear, that's presented to us in words. It's information that we read in stories, things like grocery lists. And what's interesting is that this is a cognitive ability that women show an advantage over men on throughout the lifespan. So this is one of the biological sex differences. And when women's ovaries are removed, when they become menopausal surgically, their verbal memory decreases. We see the same phenomenon when women transition naturally through the menopause, that there is this specific decline in the ability to learn verbal material and then to recall that verbal material later. And because it's a cognitive ability that we rely on so much, it can be problematic in women's lives. And so the signal from the scientific studies is that 5 of 6 longitudinal studies show a decline in this cognitive ability as women transition. So it's a very reliable signal. Changes in other cognitive domains like attention, they're not reliable. The speed with which we can complete tasks, that doesn't seem to change. We call that processing speed. But what does seem to change with menopause stage, meaning pre versus perimenopause, is this decline in verbal learning and verbal memory.
Gotcha. And so is the memory loss that's associated with the menopause, is that something to worry about per se?
Yes, we can measure this decline in memory. And for women, it can be quite frightening, especially if we have a family history of Alzheimer's disease. We might be thinking, oh, my word, you know, am I getting Alzheimer's disease? And to complicate matters, there's a lot of myths and misunderstanding on social media that's saying when you lose your estrogen, you're on the path to dementia. So if there's one message I want to share with your listeners, it's that let's think about this logically for a second. Every woman who lives into late life will experience a decline in her estrogen from menopause. 100% of women. And if menopause caused dementia, then 100% of us should be demented. So logically, menopause in and of itself can't be a transition state into dementia for all women. That just can't logically be the case because about 20% of us appear to be at risk. The question is, for whom is the menopause transition an important time to be thinking about what we can do to optimize our brain health? So if logically all of us lose our estrogen, but not all of us dement and not all of us experience cognitive declines, about 40% of us at maximum seem to either report or show this, then what is it about the menopause? Here's where my science and the science of my collaborators points to, let's talk about the menopause symptoms and their role in cognitive function. And this is where hot flashes come into play. And this is where sleep comes into play and mood. So we can talk about all of those.
Let's do that. And so I want to touch on those areas, and I think it might dovetail here, but hopefully I'm not putting the cart before the horse, but there has been in general a lot of confusion over the years regarding hormone therapy and its relationship to cognition or risk prevention of dementia. Can you help us kind of understand what the latest science would say?
Yes. You might recall that I said we really want to rely on reproducible findings in the scientific literature. So it's important to understand what studies have been done and what they show and what studies haven't been done, but should be done. So let's talk about what we do know. What we do know is that menopausal hormone therapy, which is typically a pill or it could be a patch or a gel that contains estrogen and brings our estrogen levels up to the level that we typically have early in our menstrual cycles. So it's meant to, if you will, replace the estrogen that's lost during the menopause transition. And then we have a progesterone. And the progesterone, if we have a uterus, is important because without that, then the estrogen can increase our risk for uterine cancer called endometrial cancer because it's the lining of the uterus. Most women who have a uterus will be on estrogen plus progesterone. That's what's recommended medically. That's what hormone therapy is. And it's right now indicated for only two purposes. One is for the treatment of hot flashes, and the other one is the treatment of what we call vulvovaginal atrophy. So changes in reproductive tissue that occur naturally as we transition through the menopause. Those are the two indications, but it's also known that it is very good to prevent fracture and to build bone. Okay, so really three things that we know, if you will, for sure, that hormone therapy is very effective in treating. But now we're hearing, especially on social media, this idea that, hey, hormone therapy is really good for cognition. So we have to ask ourselves, what's the evidence here? There's quite reliable evidence that hormone therapy is really important to maintain cognitive function in women who transition early. So women who experience the onset of menopause, say before age 45, and especially those who experience the onset of menopause before age 40. There is quite convincing evidence from randomized trials, albeit small ones, from a recent study I just published in women who have the BRCA gene and undergo menopause early for that purpose, that estrogen is a really good idea. But most of us don't have early menopause. Most of us transition naturally. And the question is, what do we know about estrogen in that setting for menopausal hormone therapy? Here we have four high-quality, large, randomized trials with different formulations of hormone therapy, and some of them up to 8 years of follow-up. All of those studies were done in women who were in what we call the early postmenopause. So say anywhere between 5 and 10 years from the final menstrual period. Those studies all show neutral effects of hormone therapy on cognition. No benefit, no harm, but they're neutral. And it doesn't matter if it's a transdermal estrogen or a pill or if it's estradiol or some kind of synthetic. Although you'll hear chatter online that, oh, it's just because they use the wrong estrogen. But all of these estrogens have been studied. What I think, Dr. Rossetti, is the key missing factor is that those studies appropriately wanted to know, does hormone therapy enhance cognition directly? Meaning, if you don't have symptoms, does hormone therapy improve your cognition? Really important scientific question. What hasn't been answered, ironically, given the fact that menopausal hormone therapy is prescribed for vasomotor symptoms, meaning hot flashes and night sweats, which 80% of us will have, we don't know what hormone therapy does to cognition in women who have hot flashes. And my work suggests that's a really big missing piece, because the science that I've been doing over the past 15 years links hot flashes themselves with declines in verbal memory, with changes in brain circuitry underlying memory performance, and then in collaboration with my colleague Rebecca Thurston, changes in the structure of the brain, meaning the more hot flashes we have, the more tiny, tiny stroke-like lesions we see on structural MRI. And then finally, most recently, the more hot flashes women have, the more Alzheimer's disease biomarkers they have in their blood. We measure these hot flashes in a very techie way. We put monitors on women and we measure changes in electrical activity on the surface of the skin that happen when we sweat suddenly. This is a really important technology because we can use it when women are sleeping and we don't always know how many hot flashes we're having when we're sleeping. We find these reliable associations. And what's interesting is that those associations, we still see them when we account for the fact that we wake up when we have hot flashes, right? So sleep disturbance is tied to hot flashes, but that doesn't explain away what we're finding with hot flashes. So we want to understand, what's the role of hot flashes in cognitive function? If you treat hot flashes, will it improve memory? And I conducted a study, a proof of concept study, randomized trial with a non-hormonal intervention, and showed that memory bounced back to the extent that hot flashes were effectively treated. So that suggests a possible causal association between hot flashes and cognitive decline. And maybe that's one of the factors that differentiates which women will experience a problem cognitively during the menopause versus which ones won't is the severity and the persistence of their hot flashes. And women experience hot flashes on average for 7.4 years, and if you're Black, for more than 10 years. And so these symptoms are not short-lived. They persist.
And so given the progress there in terms of realizing there may be a reason here to personalize treatment based on the patient and how they're presenting and the things that we still don't know, clinically, is there enough there to guide clinicians in terms of deciding what patient is an ideal patient to offer this for or to make guidance around what women are being offered?
Yes, it's the question. Menopausal hormone therapy is indicated for hot flashes. So what our work suggests is that if you treat those hot flashes, you're going to get an improvement in memory as well. In women with hot flashes, hormone therapy also improves sleep. And you don't need this podcast or your expertise or mine to know that if you haven't slept well day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, your cognition is
going
to suffer, right? Your cognition is going to suffer. So the good news about menopausal hormone therapy is that it's effective for treating, we think, cognitive issues related to sleep deprivation because it does improve sleep in women whose sleep is disrupted by hot flashes. But here's the thing. Two-thirds of the time that we're not sleeping when we want to be sleeping has nothing to do with hot flashes. So hot flashes explain about a third of our sleep disruption during this period of our lives. The other two-thirds doesn't have anything to do with hot flashes. Their hormone therapy doesn't do anything. Hormone therapy is not effective in improving sleep. Now, if a woman takes a progesterone pill at night, it can improve her sleep. So interestingly, the estrogen really helps with the hot flashes. The progesterone at night can help us sleep because it works on this neurotransmitter called GABA that's really important in settling us down and calming us. It's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. It's an inhibitory brain chemical. It helps the brain, if you will, to quiet down. So many women find relief with the progesterone for sleep. But for the rest of women, and for the rest of our sleep disturbance, we need better sleep habits. We need some sleep hygiene, ideally cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. We just need to build better sleep habits, which is so much harder than it sounds, right? Going to bed at the same time every night. But man, when you get a good sleep for a while, your brain can really benefit. To your point, women who have hot flashes should be on hormone therapy if they're bothersome because hot flashes are associated with a lot of disruption in quality of life. So if they and their care provider want to treat those hot flashes, memory might bounce back. There's also a non-hormonal therapy that's been FDA approved. It's called fezolinetant. Takes hot flashes away really quickly. It's highly effective. It also seems to benefit sleep. And it works specifically on an area of the brain that causes us to have hot flashes and might cause the sleep disruption. We don't know yet. So the good news is that even if women are concerned about hormone therapy safety, and that's a whole other conversation, I'll just say briefly that medical organizations, consensus guidelines say that for the large majority of women who are early in their menopause experience, it's safe. Having those hot flashes is not necessarily safe. It's not like you're having the risks of hormone therapy against no risk because having those symptoms is bad for our health. And I don't think women think in that space normally. But, you know, our work suggests that if you're having those hot flashes and they're kind of moderate to severe, then it could be affecting your brain.
Right. That does seem like a big point of education for us as women, because I agree with you that I think most women just think of hot flashes as like a trial and a tribulation to be endured. And it's something that's been mocked endlessly on comedies. And yes, we don't have this idea that this in and of itself is a negative thing for my health in various ways. You alluded to this earlier when you mentioned that hot flashes for Black women may persist longer than their counterparts. Are there other things that we know about how this whole process in terms of the menopause and cognition differs by SES or race?
Yeah. And this is a critically important issue. So We just did a study, my graduate student, now Dr. Alexandra Paget-Blanc, did a dissertation study where she put our hot flash monitors on a group of really well-educated, high IQ Black women. I think the sample was 75% Black and 25% Latina. The average number of objective hot flashes that these women had was 27 per day. Now, how do we put that into perspective? To qualify for an FDA trial of a new treatment for improving hot flashes, you have to have 35 hot flashes per week. So these women are having 27 per day. These are women who are jobs like yours and mine, who are trying to function, and they are having 27 hot flashes a day, and their sleep is also very disrupted. So I think while the literature has spoken to the endurance, like how long Black and Brown women experience hot flashes, for Latinas, it's about 9 years. I don't think we've fully appreciated their frequency. And that's one of the beautiful contributions of Dr. Paget-Blanc's work. So our study, published maybe 6 years ago, maybe 7 years ago, followed a large cohort of Black and Brown women who live in poverty. So a different segment in women of color. And what we showed in that study is that those women, unlike what other cohort studies have shown, this was more than 400 women followed for more than 10 years. These studies are really hard to do. They take a long time. But what we found is that those women, as expected, based on other cohort studies, did show a decline in their ability to learn and remember words, but they also showed a small decline in their working memory and attention. So their ability to listen to what you and I are saying, or maybe keep what you and I are saying online and manipulate that information in some way in their mind. So they're showing that as well. And unlike other cohort studies, this sample of women showed persistent declines into the postmenopause. So many studies in white women, though not all, in cohorts, I should say, that are comprised primarily of white women, show an improvement in the postmenopause, at least in our ability to recall items. Problems encoding information might persist. And I should say, this is still within normal limits. These studies measure these declines, but they're small, say a half a word out of an average recall of 8 words out of 16. Okay, so that's what we're talking about. It's a small effect, but it's measurable, but it's not like we're demented. What was interesting in this group of Black and Brown women, low-income women of color, was that those declines persisted, but we also could measure in about 9% of those women frank cognitive impairment, meaning new onset of cognitive impairment. They were performing much more poorly than expected for their age and education than their peers. And we were surprised that we actually saw frank cognitive impairment. But now that I see, and Dr. Rossetti, I'm going to have to tie these two together scientifically, but it seems intuitive that this is because their hot flashes aren't being treated. They're experiencing them longer and more frequently. And I think optimizing brain health for Black and Brown women, we really, really need to focus on adequate treatment of their menopause symptoms. It's not the same for all women. The Chinese and Japanese women have fewer hot flashes than white women and Black and Brown women. It's not the same experience for all women.
Speaking of maybe not treatment, but more lifestyle recommendations, those types of things, is there a science-backed recommendation or two that you would particularly suggest to our listeners who are pre-menopause? And would that be any different for someone who's already crossed that bridge?
What we recommend to optimize brain health at midlife is based primarily on what's been studied in the cognitive aging literature. And I think the way that I perceive menopause is that menopause is an opportunity to build resilience in our brains so that if and when the pathology of Alzheimer's disease enters our brain, if you will, we're optimally resilient. I don't think the menopause itself is inextricably tied to the Alzheimer's disease process pathologically. Maybe for women with a particular genotype, maybe it's a theory. I think for most of us, we want to build a really healthy brain. And to your point, I think that should start in the premenopause. And it starts with the recommendations that groups like the Alzheimer's Association recommend. So we want to maintain our heart health. We want to limit hypertension. We want to limit diabetes and prediabetes. We want to maintain healthy cholesterol levels. We want to engage in aerobic exercise for at least 150 minutes per week. We want to eat more of the Mediterranean diet than our cravings might suggest that we do. We want to avoid head injuries. We want to engage socially. We want to have conversations. We want to get our depression treated. And we want to avoid excess alcohol and smoking. The good news for us, the really positive news, is that though most of us fear dementia, evidence suggests that 40% of our risk of dementia is under our control with those lifestyle factors. And so that's really good news for women. And so we want to bring into menopause the most resilient brain we can. We want to build the best sleep habits we can before we enter it. We want to build habits, exercise habits. I don't want to give women another thing to do. We have plenty to do. We tend to feel guilty about way too much. But, you know, maybe grab the hummus a little more often than you grab the chips. Maybe park a little further away. Just baby steps. Build it into your life. Build a habit. Chain it to behaviors. Do something before you have your morning coffee, that kind of thing. Also, this idea of not using alcohol as a stress relief is really important. Building alternative pathways of dealing with stress, because I think a lot of women are dealing with a lot of stressors. They've got aging parents, they have children, they have careers, they have lots of demands on themselves. And it can be difficult to find time in the day to really just de-stress. And I think some women might go for that second glass of wine, but, you know, having more than one a day is not recommended if we're female. I know it's, you know, really shocking. And now there's this question of whether any alcohol itself is okay. It's not only what we do, but it's what we avoid.
Dr. Mackey, is there one thing going on TikTok, Instagram, whatever, in terms of a trend in this area or a piece of misinformation or myth that you wish that you could just reach through the screen and remove from our society? What would that be?
This idea that women should be on hormone therapy to prevent dementia is in a data-free space. In fact, the only randomized trial we have of hormone therapy to prevent dementia showed that this formulation, which women are no longer on, doubled the risk of dementia. People said, oh, that's the wrong formulation of hormone therapy. Nobody's on it. And if you just take estradiol, which is the kind of estrogen that we produce naturally, then it'll yield different results. Well, we have four recent large studies with more than 400,000 people, probably even more, from four different countries where, you know, they have these beautiful medical records. You know, Scandinavia, you can get the whole nation. Finland, you can get the whole nation. So you can ask questions in these populations. All four of them showed a small increased risk of dementia in women who used hormone therapy. It's not so large that you wouldn't want to use hormone therapy. You know, you'd have to treat, say, 3,000 or 4,000 women to produce one case of dementia. So it shouldn't, I don't think it should change the use. It's rare. You know, alcohol is associated with a much higher risk of dementia than that. So I don't think that should affect our decision-making about whether we treat our hot flashes. But nonetheless, there's one meta-analysis whose conclusions are cited widely, but that are contradicted by another meta-analysis. And the data selected in that wouldn't be the data that the study authors necessarily would have chosen to be included. So women should not be using hormone therapy to prevent dementia. They should be using it to treat their hot flashes. there are many, many more tried and true and tested approaches to preventing dementia. And I think this idea that you just take estrogen is not only neutral, but potentially harmful to women. Nonetheless, people are making a lot of money saying this.
All right. Well, there's an Everest for us. Lastly, Dr. Mackey, what is on the horizon research-wise on this topic that has you most excited right now?
We mentioned at the beginning that we have this reliable evidence that there is this measurable decline in our ability to learn and remember verbal material. And at that time, I mentioned, we don't have those longitudinal studies on what happens to the brain to explain that. Well, those studies are underway now. It takes a long time to do a good study. There's some cross-sectional studies where you compare a group of pre to a group of peri to a group of postmenopausal women, and it's fully appropriate to do those studies. They've raised certain theories about what might be happening to the brain, and those need to be tested in longitudinal studies. Some of those theories have this idea that, maybe the female brain changes its energy source. Maybe there's a loss of function in a particular brain area. And then there's beautiful data by Emily Jacobs that suggests that our memory systems rewire. And I'm very partial to that theory because it aligns so beautifully with the data showing that memory declines. Like it's very logical, right? It doesn't mean that other factors might not be going on, but I think we can look forward in the next few years to some of the first longitudinal data. Some of that comes from my study with Susan Buchheimer and the Human Connectome Project, as well as studies that I'm doing with Rebecca Thurston in a newly funded NIH study called MenoBrain. So we will have some large-scale studies. I think that just as there are some women who develop postpartum depression, right? It's not most of us. 9 to 15% of us develop postpartum depression. So there's a sensitivity to the loss of estrogen in a segment of women when it comes to brain functioning. I think we need to understand whether there is a subpopulation of women for whom the menopause and the estrogen declines that occur then might confer a risk for Alzheimer's disease. I think we can't generalize that. We know postpartum depression is associated with hormone withdrawal, and we know it is a hormone-driven thing, but it doesn't apply to most women. So it makes sense that there may be a subpopulation of women who are, in fact, very sensitive cognitively to the withdrawal of estrogen. So we need to figure out who those women are. And then I think we need additional evidence of a causal association between hot flashes and memory problems. I published the one study. I want to be my own critic here and say, really, we need more than one to show definitively that there is a causal association here. But I think at least what it means is that if we're women who have moderate to severe hot flashes, it is a marker that we should be paying attention to what we're doing to optimize our brain health. So even if it's just a marker, I think it's informative and it tells us, hey, let's pay better attention. But a lot of what we do is under our control. And I think we need clinical trials of things like cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. Does that help our cognition? Like if we treat that sleep, is that going to help our cognition? We have some proposals out to test that. And then your really important question about, who do we really need to be focusing on? And I think we need to be focusing on Black and brown women. I mean, I think we have an obligation to study a group that's showing the risk factors proportionately that we think are linked to cognitive decline. So there's a lot on the forefront. There's a lot more people. I used to be one of the only people studying menopause decades ago. Thankfully, there's a whole new generation that's coming in. So let's see what this young workforce does.
That's right. I know. Thankfully, you've set a trend that's become much more than a trend for sure, which is so encouraging. And I really want to thank you so much for taking the time to share your life's work and expertise and knowledge on a topic that is so relevant and pressing for at least half the population and those who love them. So thank you so much for that.
Thanks to you, Dr. Rossetti, and thanks to NAN, an incredible organization, for their support of educating the population about this important topic. This is exactly what we need because there's so much misinformation out there. It's really great when societies spend their time to share evidence-based information, it really can help women a lot.
That's the goal. Thank you again. Thank you for tuning in to the Brain Beat podcast. For more in-depth information on brain health and the latest in brain science, visit us at brainwisemedia.com. Don't forget to follow BrainWise on social media for regular updates and tips. We're at BrainWise Media across all platforms. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate, subscribe, and leave a review. Your feedback helps us reach more listeners and improve our content. Stay curious, stay informed, and keep your brain in top shape.